By the end of the week, some 16,000 U.S. military personnel will be involved in the Haiti relief effort. NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore says as the U.S. takes the lead in Haiti, it should make sure its role has an international stamp of approval.
So far, at least, the Haiti catastrophe has not become a partisan issue as Hurricane Katrina did. It undoubtedly helped that President Obama quickly enlisted ex-presidents Clinton and Bush to spearhead the fundraising effort. But it's important, as reconstruction work begins, that the United States and the family of nations agree on some central authority to supervise what may be the creation of a new state. President Obama speaks of a path to a brighter future. Under the stopgap arrangement in effect since the earthquake, the United States and the United Nations handle much of the flow of aid in cooperation with the Haitian government, they say. But President René Préval's government, for all practical purposes, does not exist. It lies in ruins in the rubble of the presidential palace and the other government buildings. With American and other foreign forces patrolling the streets of Port-au-Prince and controlling traffic through the airport, Haitian leaders say they hope this will be temporary. What is needed now is some generally accepted authority representing the family of nations. History provides some examples of benign governorship of countries not yet ready for self-government. I am thinking of the mandate system introduced by the League of Nations after World War I and the trusteeship system of the United Nations after World War II. Trusteeship, which officially ended in 1994, was a way of guiding countries towards autonomy with shadow governments reporting to the United Nations Trusteeship Council. Among the nations that experienced some version of trusteeship are Bosnia, Kosovo, East Timor, and Cambodia. The United States will undoubtedly bear much of the burden of building back better, as Mr. Clinton, the UN Special Envoy to Haiti, puts it. But it would be well if America did it under international supervision. What nobody needs is the United States coming to be perceived by Haitians as an occupying power, making the basic decisions about the rebirth of this benighted little country. This is Daniel Shore.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Well, log on for free while you can. The New York Times announced today that beginning next year, it will start charging readers for its web content. After a long internal debate, the Times management came up with a meter system. After a number of free visits, a reader will be charged for certain articles. And here to talk about whether this is a good idea and whether it will save the newspaper business is Jay Rosen. He's a journalism professor at NYU. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, everyone in the media has been trying to figure out how to make money off the web. And is this the savior?
There's really no way to tell yet. It's a gamble by the New York Times. I don't think they know if it's going to work. And we still have a lot of details missing from their plan. So we're just going to have to see what happens.
Although there is some history with the New York Times, because several years ago it tried to implement what they called Times Select, where they asked people to pay to read certain columnists, and then they abandoned it, I guess, because it wasn't working.
Well, it's not exactly true that they abandoned it because it wasn't working. They actually met their targets. They got quite a few people to sign up, and they were earning revenues off Times Select. However, what they discovered was that the traffic coming from search, mainly from Google, to the New York Times was so strong that they could probably make more money by opening the gates and making themselves very amenable to Google.
So now, do they want to give up this accessibility for Google by charging for the content?
Well, this is the reason they have gone to what's called a metered system, where after a certain number of visits, you have to pay. But by having this cushion, they hope to contain the damage and get as many users from Google as possible and only charge the people who are very heavy users of the site. That's the reason for this metered system.
But the web is a wild and woolly place, and I imagine there are all sorts of ways to get around this.
There's the threat of people posting content from the Times at blogs and other sites without authorization. But even more troubling is the possibility that people will just go elsewhere to, for example, the Guardian site, which the editor there just yesterday said they plan to remain free. Or the Washington Post, which has said it doesn't have plans to charge for content, or indeed NPR.org. And so these are some of the variables that the Times executives were juggling. And part of the judgment they probably made is that we have authoritative reporting in journalism, and to some degree they are gambling on that itself.
That people will be willing to fork over money for this unique content.
Yes. But there's another issue here, which is that the people who work for the New York Times believe that their journalism should be addressed to the public at large. And one of the things that happens when you start to charge is you're in effect cutting yourself off from the widest possible public your journalism can reach. And if the real product of the New York Times is its influence, then this is a very risky move with the very heart and soul of the newspaper, which is its ability to affect and influence public conversation.
But not to sound too flip about it, those journalists, when faced with the choice of being accessible to the world or having a job, would probably choose the latter.
Well, that is right. And it is a difficult choice. And that's one reason they agonized about it for more than a year and still haven't really figured out the details.
Jay Rosen teaches journalism at NYU and writes the Press Think blog. Jay Rosen, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I'm Lynn Neary, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, our panel of moms talk about the work-life-motherhood balance and the art of time management. But first, we look at a new book. Of the many peculiarities of the peculiar institution known as slavery, perhaps none is as hard to fathom as the relationship between slave owners and the slaves who were their lovers and sometimes the mother of their children. It is this relationship that Dolan Perkins Valdez explores in her novel Wench. Set mostly on a resort in Ohio where southern slave owners sometimes vacationed with the slaves who were their mistresses, the story focuses on four of these women, Lizzie, Renee, Sweet, and Ma Wu, a newcomer tempted by the scent of freedom in the North who begins to talk about escape. Ma Wu's defiance unsettles Lizzie's world and her complex relationship with the man who is her owner and the father of her children. Dolan Perkins Valdez joins us now to talk about her book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you first to set the scene, because this is a really interesting place that I never understood could have existed. It's a resort in the North, but southern slave owners would vacation there with their mistresses. And it was a real place, right?
Right.
Tell me more about it.
Well, one of the things that allowed them to go there were the advances in transportation at the time. So they would ride the steamship up the Mississippi River and then veer off onto the Ohio River. And when they got off the ship, they could take the train up to Xenia, Ohio. And that was a new railroad. It was the Little Miami Railroad. I think when Elias Drake opened the resort, he did not expect that it would become popular among slaveholders and these women. But that was sort of an unintended effect just based on the fact that they were able to get there.
How did you first hear about this resort?
I first heard about it while reading a biography of W.E.B. Du Bois by David Levering Lewis called Biography of a Race, and it was in the section of the book where he talks about the time that Du Bois taught at Wilberforce University, and he said he was talking about the origins of Wilberforce University, and he said that it may have been, and I'm paraphrasing here, the most unusual resort hotel in America because it was popular among slaveholders and their enslaved mistresses. And I said, what? And I couldn't believe it. I had never heard of this before. And then he moved on to something else. And so it was sort of just one of those little historical footnotes that I tried to take and imagine what that place would have been like.
And was it hard for you to just even delve into this history, some of the things that you learned? Maybe there were things you hadn't known before.
Delving into the history was actually most fascinating for me. Finding out, for example, that many of the early students at Wilberforce University were the children of Southern planters, And I think that the historical research of it was really actually more fascinating than anything else because I didn't know any of this.
Interesting. And the story focuses a lot on a slave named Lizzie, and her master, Drail, began sleeping with her when she was barely in her teens. And if you could read a section from the book, it sort of explains how that relationship with him begins.
He brought her books. The first word she learned to read and write was she, and it delighted her so much she wrote it everywhere she could. She wrote it in the biscuit batter with her spoon. She dug it in the dirt out back with a stick. She sketched it in the steamy windows when it rained. When she pricked her palm with a kitchen knife, she squeezed the skin until she could write her new word out with blood on a scrap of cloth. She traced the word with her fingers on the smooth parts of his body while they lay together in the storeroom at night. She was afraid of him, but with each reading lesson she allowed him to take one more step with her. At first, he told her he just wanted to touch her tiny breast. Then, he said, he just wanted to place his hand on her hip. At first, he asked to touch her. Later, he did not. Each touch was like a payment for his kindnesses.
And, of course, Lizzie is 13 years old. She's so young and so vulnerable at this point. She really doesn't entirely understand what she's getting into, what price she's going to pay for these moments of kindness.
Right, and I tried to, in that scene in particular, describe how it was a bit of a seduction of her. And later, as we view Lizzie when she's a little bit older, or a lot older, we can understand a little bit better why she feels so confused about her feelings about him. He's like her father. He's like a lover. He's so many things to her, and it's a very complicated relationship. And I thought it necessary to go back to that original moment in which he seduces her to explain why she feels so confused about the predicament she's in.
Let me ask you about Mawu, the character of Mawu. This is a woman who is a slave who, unlike the other slaves who have been visiting this resort for a number of years, she realizes that they are in free territory. She understands what that means, and to her it means they should be trying to escape.
Right. She can't understand why they aren't trying to escape, and she goads them on from the very beginning of the book to try to escape. She doesn't understand why Lizzie feels this emotional attachment to her master. There's a line earlier in the book where Lizzie says, "I like spending time with my man," and Mawu says to her, "He not your man, you know."
And what does she represent to these other women? How does she shake up their world?
I mean, she shakes up their world in so many ways. Practices a form of hoodoo and rejects what she believes to be the passivity of Christianity. She despises her master and fights him. She represents to them all of the things that they maybe have considered becoming in the past but have never had the courage to be or to do. And so I do think that she changes things for them in a really profound way.
I think one thing that this book makes you understand is, as you said, what the slaves are really up against. It's not only the power of the individual slave owner, but the entire structure that's sort of set up to support that power. And it makes you realize how hard it was to escape from that, to get away from that.
Right. Not only is it hard, you know, we talk about the system of slavery, not only is it hard for the women to escape, it's hard for Fran to escape it, his white wife. It's hard for Drail to escape it. When we see him at the resort in front of the other southern planters, he is different than he is with Lizzie when they're alone. And so it's a system that everybody finds themselves enmeshed in some way. And that's the thing I think that makes telling any story of slavery, I think, so compelling, because you find out just how much the immorality of the institution affected everyone who had anything to do with it.
Dolan Perkins Valdez is the author of the new book, Wench. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Two best-selling authors died in the past several days, and both of them are associated with one particular city, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Eric Siegel was an accomplished classics scholar, but he's best known for the tearjerker Love Story. And mystery writer Robert Parker was the man behind the Spencer series. Commentator Mo Lottman reflects on their legacies and the city that inspired their most popular works.
If you live in or around Cambridge, Massachusetts, the news this week has marked the end of an era. And no, I'm not talking about the Scott Brown Senate victory. Two famous writers with local connections have passed away. One penned the novel and screenplay Love Story, perhaps the most famous movie ever set here. The other lived in Harvard Square and put his most celebrated character in the alleys and bars of the neighborhood. On the surface, it would seem the two men have little in common. Okay, maybe it's not just on the surface. Eric Segal was a rabbi's son from Brooklyn who eventually moved to England. Robert Parker was born and bred in Massachusetts, served in Korea, and lived on Ash Street in Cambridge until his death. Segal wrote one enormously successful work and then largely faded from the spotlight. Parker churned out bestseller after bestseller, some of which were turned into television shows and films. Parker was a gruff but unpretentious family man who named a succession of dogs Pearl and hated academics. Segal was fluent in several languages and a professor at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Oxford. To get an idea for the difference, just look at who played the leading men in the screen adaptations of their work. With Parker, it's Robert Urich, Tom Selleck, and Ed Harris. With Segal, it's Ryan O'Neill. But Cambridge is a funny place. Like Love Story's Oliver Barrett IV and Jenny Cavallari, it's a marriage between Brahmin and working class, a mix that, like Jenny's owl glasses, shouldn't work, but does. Harvard has turned out presidents, princes, senators, and Supreme Court justices, but it also hired Timothy Leary. A whole generation of psychedelic wanderers have hung out in Harvard Square, as did the founders of Microsoft. The Boston Bruins drank at the Oxford Grill, where bar brawls would spill out into the street every weekend. But 50 feet away, earnest guitarists sang to hushed audiences in the liquor-free folk club Passim. Jugglers hammed it up for summer strollers, while punks in studded collars lit up doobies on the subway plaza. Even Parker Spencer knew that brawn and street smarts was better leavened with a little sophistication. Sure, he was a tough detective and an ex-boxer, but he was also a gourmet who dated a psychologist. Before he was famous, Robert Parker wrote manuals for Raytheon. A snippet of technical writing for a missile begins, "To start, push to start button." Before he was famous, Segal wrote a 300-page essay on the comedy of Roman playwright Plautus. Somehow, both of these gentlemen represent Cambridge, Massachusetts, in all its contradictory glory. Here's hoping they're sharing a whiskey or a lemon spritzer in the great Harvard Square in the sky.
Commentator Mo Lotman remembering the late writers Eric Segal and Robert Parker. Lotman is author of Harvard Square, an Illustrated History, since 1950.